it was the first time I'd really heard a scientist plant a flag in terms of a timeline on a certain time in the future when a great insight will be gained. This was a crazy idea that we could do a human brain in 10 years. And I continued to run into that criticism. And to this day, I mean, people who have seen this film and reacted to it think that that's a crazy landmark to be thinking of in any kind of time frame of a decade. You want to feel like the work you're doing has a real has an actual impact in your lifetime, in the community of humans you live amongst. And when you're doing such a long-term speculative project that's building a model from the bottom up over so much time, what keeps you in it? What keeps you bound to the work?
This is Brain Inspired.
That was Noah Hutton, and I am Paul Middlebrooks. Welcome to Brain Inspired. This is a different kind of episode for Brain Inspired, partly because Noah is not officially a scientist or philosopher, but a filmmaker. And starting today, his documentary, In Silico, is available to stream on Vimeo. In Silico is the result of Noah's 10-plus year journey capturing the progress of massively funded projects in neuroscience, the Blue Brain Project and the Human Brain Project, which we discuss in the episode. The reason it took about 10 years is because that's the time frame that Henry Markram set for himself and a large team of scientists, given enough funding to build a full simulation of a human brain in all its gnarly detail and complexity. That aspiration was first articulated in a 2009 TED Talk by Henry, a TED Talk that drew Noah in and sparked what has become In Silico. Noah was generous and allowed myself and Brain Inspired Patreon supporters to screen the film, and he agreed to record this episode live with a bunch of those Patreon supporters to field their questions and mine about his experiences and the science and the people involved in the science. So a different kind of episode on that front as well. Especially if you enjoy Brain Inspired, you'll enjoy In Silico, and you're doing yourself a disservice if you don't watch it. I'm actually recording this before I have the Vimeo link, but I will put that link in the show notes at braininspired.co/podcast/147, or you can just go straight to the film's website, which is insilicofilm.com, and you'll find links there. So I said that Noah is not a scientist, but you might not know that by listening to him. As you'll hear, he's always been interested in neuroscience and is quite knowledgeable about it. So enjoy Noah. Noah Hutton, In Silico. Congratulations. First of all, congratulations on the film and a huge thank you for sharing it with my podcast supporters. You were gracious enough to give us a screening, and now we're all, many of us are here anyway to ask you questions and learn more about the film. So thanks.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm an avid listener of your show, so I really, it's an honor to be here, and I appreciate you all watching the film.
So I guess this will come out either the day of or maybe the day after the release of the film, but are you going to have like a premiere or an event?
There is a event in New York City on the premiere date, so that's September 13th. And Sandbox Films, the company that financed the film, mostly, we also got some funding from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Sandbox Films is going to host this event at the Angelica Theater in New York. So I'm excited for that. I've never seen the film with a real audience. We had a virtual theatrical run, which was a big COVID term. And I had two films come out during COVID. This one, also a narrative sci-fi feature called Lapsus. And both of them had these virtual theatrical runs where I never got to see them with an audience. So I'm particularly excited to be able to, be in a room with people watching the film, because that's how I'm used to releasing the work, and it's been a funny time to do it all virtually.
And I'm really naive about how film works, but is it going to be in theaters after that, in some limited number of theaters, or is it just going to be the premiere event, or is that something that gets determined after?
It might have been, but because we did this virtual theatrical, we kind of that blew our theatrical run. We were in theaters virtually all across the country.
Yeah.
So, you know, but they were hosting it on streaming services. So it won't be in physical theaters. So that day it's released on streaming platforms, so people can access it on iTunes, for example, on Apple TV. And the one that I'm pointing people to the most is Vimeo On Demand. I don't know how many people watch or rent movies on Vimeo, but it's the only platform for us where the film will be available all over the world. So it's sort of the widest reach. So Vimeo On Demand on September 13th.
And what's after the premiere? What's the after party going to be like?
I don't know. It's also a strange thing having not gone out much, and you know, and I live in upstate New York, so it's sort of going to be quite a shock for me to go into the big city after all this time and have a party. I don't know. Some people might be well used to this already by now, but I've been up in the country.
And last question about the premiere. Are you going to invite Markram? Is he going to be there?
I don't think so. We can talk about this more, but it's been a pretty icy response from him and the project to this film, which I totally expected and understand.
Well, so the film ends with you showing them making their own movie, which may or may not be a response to your documentary, which we'll get into more here in just a moment. But I mean, is that did that come out, or are they in production on that? Do you know?
I don't know. I've actually heard rumors at some of these virtual screenings I've been doing that they are working on a response documentary. I'd be eager to see that. I haven't heard anything more about it. I don't know when it will come out. That film that there, as you mentioned at the end, not to give away too much, but at the end of In Silico, my film, there is a film that they are working on, and it at the time it struck me as just another of in a long series of promotional films that they make about their work. And you know, that's how I got into making this film in the first place. I saw one of their, you know, stunning fly-through videos of this little piece of, you know, cortex, and I decided to make my film. So I understand well the power of the visualization. It's what got me involved in the first place. But I came to be quite critical, and we can talk more about that of the promotional efforts and the emphasis on them. And I think that film that they're making near the end of In Silico is just sort of another one of those.
So you started off, I guess, an undergraduate taking a bunch of neuroscience courses, and I understand that you took enough of those courses to have majored in neuroscience, should you have wanted to. Is that right?
Well, at my university, I went to Wesleyan University, which is, you know, a liberal arts college, and so I was actually an art history major. Although I took as many neuroscience classes as art history classes, so I felt like I was double majoring, but I actually didn't get a neuroscience degree because to get that degree, you do have to do a year of orgo, a year of physics, a year of biology. So I didn't really want to do that. I wanted just to take the upper level neuroscience classes, which I did, and I took like, you know, nine of those, I think. And I think you had to take nine art history courses to major. So I felt like I was double majoring, but I wasn't. I was just getting an art history degree. But it felt like a good preparation to go make this film because we were assigned. I was taking a mammalian cortical circuits class, and we were assigned the Markram papers from the 90s with Bert Sockman and others. And you know, I was already enamored by that work. And then so to see his TED talk and to have that trust, that foundation of trust built, it allowed me to, I think, to be swept away in a certain way.
But not you didn't fall in love with neuroscience enough to be swept away with neuroscience because your real passion is filmmaking, I suppose, and art.
Yeah, I guess my craft is filmmaking, but I think some people go to, you know, school for film. A lot of people go to film school. And are swept away in a certain more direct way by film and film history. And I never got into all that. I never was like a film nerd, and I never got into the craft in that way. I was always trying to make films about the things I was interested in. And so neuroscience was really the thing I was interested in. And it was my intellectual passion. And film for me was a craft. And art history, I never did anything with. So it's one of those stale liberal arts degrees sitting on my, you know, shelf. I don't know. I thought maybe sometime I would be like working in a museum or something, but I never went down that road.
Okay, so well, you read these papers by Markram and others, and then you saw this TED talk. It kind of starts with Markram's infamous, I suppose now, TED Talk, where he describes a project whereby within 10 years, they will fully simulate a human brain. And you were, optimistic, I suppose, in the beginning. And this sort of set off the beginnings of the project. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I came out of reading these papers. I went over there very wide-eyed. I'd also read, if maybe listeners remember, I read there was this profile by Jonah Lehrer at the time, who was writing, I believe, in Seed magazine, and wrote a very glowing portrait of Markram as this kind of rock star of neuroscience, and had gone over there himself and had gotten a tour around their machine room. And I'd read that. I had seen their videos online. I'd seen the TED Talk, and I went over there, and this came out of also a place of I did want to make a film about neuroscience. I had already made a documentary about the oil boom in North Dakota, and that was my first film. And I made that as a senior in college, called Crude Independence. And I'd gone and lived in North Dakota for a while.
Wow.
Hang on,
how was that experience living in North Dakota?
It was really the beginnings of this like Wild West oil boom out there. It was the beginning of fracking and oil drilling in North Dakota, which continued for, and continues to this day. But people were lining up at dawn at the courthouse to, get land deeds. And it really had this boomtown feel. And it was great for me to kind of cut my teeth as a new documentary filmmaker and out on my own out there, getting out of my East Coast bubble for sure. And I learned a ton making that film. And then I wasn't necessarily like passionate about that sub. It wasn't my intellectual passion. I think I had seen like There'll Be Blood, that movie, and I think I was like, oh my god, this is like the real world version of that happening, and that swept me away, and enough to make the film. But I met some wonderful people out there, and I actually ended up making another film there in 2015 called Deep Time, which is so I kind of had this parallel track all these years of making these environmental films about North Dakota, but I really wanted to make a film about neuroscience. I wanted to make a brain documentary of some kind, but it's difficult. I found because you often think when you go into making a film, a documentary, so certainly if you're writing a screenplay, you need to think about this. But I think a lot of people who go into documentaries, it is a little risky to go into it totally open ended, not knowing exactly where you might land, where your story might land for an ending, especially if you're spending your own money on it, or if you're trying to get funding, you definitely need to do this. You need to write what the equivalent of grant applications are to get someone to believe that you actually have a film here about something. But for me, I was with my brain documentary with the beginnings of this film, I was self-funding, and I was doing freelance work then in New York, doing commercials and so forth. And so it was very risky for me to think about beginning a film with my own money. Where was this going to go? And I couldn't figure out with neuroscience stories where the ending would be. I really found it difficult to see out of anything any lab was doing. Like, in the discussion sections and conclusions of papers, there's stuff dangled about, curing a cure for Alzheimer's, or this will lead to, or certainly about consciousness. There's like the sort of like dangling fruit of will we crack the secret of consciousness. I thought, well, I could make a film about these things, but this was so far fetched and was always kind of punted over the horizon of whatever research I was tracking that year or something. So I found it difficult to think about what would the third act be for a documentary about this subject. And it was when I saw this TED Talk in 2009 by Henry Markram, where it was the first time I'd really heard a scientist plant a flag in terms of a timeline on a certain time in the future when a great insight will be gained. And I, in retrospect, listen, I was 22. I was very... as I mentioned, I had read the papers and I was enamored by this scientist. And I think I was much more easily swept away then than I would be now in my, 30 something brain. But
now that you're cynical and pessimistic.
Yeah, right. I was taken by the idea that, 10 years felt like long enough that anything could happen, but yet for a 22-year-old somewhat short enough that I could imagine finishing this film in a, you know, 32 felt like so far away for me, but still a decade didn't seem crazy. And I thought, if I just stick with it, if he says he's going to do this in 10 years, and if I go once a year at least, and I track this, that's an interesting timeline for film. And I liked the idea of longitudinal films. I was inspired by the series Michael Apted had done, the 7-Up series, if people are familiar with that, where he tracked a group of people every 7 years for their entire lives and made this ongoing documentary about it. And so there's been some wonderful longitudinal documentaries that were kind of reference points for me. And I thought, okay, I'm going to jump in and do this. I'm going to go over there the first year. I had done a music video for Joe Ledoux's band, The Amygdaloids.
I saw that he was like a producer on in the credits, and I was wondering how that came about. So is that?
Yeah. So I was doing music videos and commercials in New York, and I was into neuroscience. So I crossed paths with Joe Ledoux.
Real cool band, right?
Yeah. Right. Cool, so he's at NYU, and he had this band called The Amygdaloids. And I did a music video for them, which is on YouTube somewhere. And Joe knew Henry, you know, I think not super well, but knew him from the community of scientists working at a high level. And so he helped me get in touch with Henry. I had emailed Henry already a couple of times and hadn't written back. So Joe helped me, said that he'd vouched for me to Henry. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how I got my first interview with Henry. And then I had just come from I had gone to a like neuroaesthetics conference in Copenhagen with my kid. I was wide-eyed. I was taking everything in. I was trying to see what I could make my film about. So I think Henry was impressed. I had come from this conference and, you know, but I really was genuinely, I wasn't there to get the scoop or show the real Blue Brain project or something. I really was genuinely going in thinking that this was going to happen and that I was going to, you know, be there to document it along the way. I had not an iota yet of sense of what the criticisms were. You know, I'm sure on that TED talk, if I had just scrolled down into the comment section, I could have seen some early criticisms. It probably would have helped me, you know, sharpen that side of the film a little bit earlier. But it took me a few years actually to even realize that there were criticisms of this project. So that's how into it I was in the beginning. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, you were working under a lot of uncertainty, which must not have felt great at times, right? But so, okay, there's already a couple of questions in the chat that I'll weave in here. One is just, you know, you went, it was 10 years, or was it beyond 10 years?
It went a little bit beyond. I mean, I did 10 visits to the project. Okay. So there was a nice sort of like wholeness in the end about that. There was once a year for 10 years, but, you know, it takes a couple of years to finish. This was a big edit. I had a lot of footage. Oh my God.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Film. Yeah. So it took a good year to just get the film edited after all that. And then it takes a while to get the film out. So that's where we are now. But at a certain point, which is I put in the film purposefully because I wanted to be a little self-aware about my own, the way I was selling my film to the world, because I got carried away, I think, with what I had become. When the Human Brain Project happened and Henry Markram leads this team that gets €1 billion from the European Commission as part of this flagship award, I was really like, oh my God, what have I've really stumbled into it here. I've hit gold. I'm part of this even bigger project now. I'm making a film about this $1 billion global project. Oh my God. And so I went on MSNBC and I said, I'm making a 15-year film, because at that point it was 5 years in, and they had launched the Human Brain Project, which had a new 10-year timeline. So I thought, okay, well, I'm making a 15-year film now. So I got carried away. I want to put that in the film itself. But in the end, I went back to my original promise to myself and, you know, to Henry, which was a 10-year film. And that's, so I cut my 15-year timeline short, and the Human Brain Project continues now, you know, and so is the Blue Brain Project. This was this was an arbitrary timeline in the end, set by the TED Talk and then followed very closely by me and maybe nobody else.
Okay, so here's a couple questions from the chat already. So you did these 10 visits to the site. Someone's wondering how much time you actually, when you visited, how much time you would actually spend on site, and just that, and then I'll add you know, what the nature of those visits were like. Were you having to try to pull people in to get people's attention, or did you have set meetings, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I would go. I went 10 years in a row. Some years I did two visits. So it wasn't an orthodox 10 trips and only 10 trips. There were several years where I went twice because there were notable things that would come up. And they would sometimes let me know about them. And sometimes I would realize that, oh, the yearly summit, you know, is happening this year in Barcelona or something. I'm going to go there, and then I'm going to go back with the team to Lausanne or something. So I would sometimes try to hit some notable event to see them outside of their labs and their offices too. And so that there's a bit of that in the film. But yeah, when I would go on these trips, the first 8 years, I self-funded everything. And that was difficult because it's very expensive to travel to Europe, and especially Switzerland was quite expensive. I'm not sure what the exchange rate is now, with the dollar is much stronger now, but at the time, Swiss francs, it was just very expensive to get there and to stay for any amount of time. So I would freelance in New York. I would save up. I would, you know, I could afford like a 4 day trip ish usually. Yeah. And I would stay maybe like 3 nights, and I would usually have like 3 full days or so at their building, and you know, they would help me create a sort of schedule of people to interview, and they had new people that might have joined the project that year. They wanted to make sure I would include, and you know, it always towed a bit of a line of I was very careful to make sure that I could that I was retaining my independence and my own control of what I was interested in, what I was filming. I did not want to become the de facto videographer for this project who would come over and they would think was capturing something for them. And that is the case. You know, I did retain my independence. We never had any agreement that was signed or any kind of,
Was it implicitly understood from them that you might be sort of on their side?
I think they hoped that. They hoped that. I don't think I led them on in any way. In fact, we had to have a couple tough conversations because in the first 5 years of this project, I was releasing yearly updates to this. And I don't know if anyone had seen those back then, but at the time, my film was called Blue Brain, and Scientific American premiered one, Vice premiered one. And they were, you know, they were like 10 or 15 minute edits that I would make from that year of footage and post online. And the first couple were probably felt to many people like they were just promotional videos for the Blue Brain project because they had no critics in them. They were just, it was just Henry talking, showing the visualizations, blah, blah, blah. Then year three, I included, and this is, no, this all got thrown up in the air and re-edited for the film in the end, plus the end of the 5 years as well. But I had Sebastian Sung's interview in year three. And that was the first piece of criticism because Sebastian had included in his book, Connectome, a bit of criticism about Henry and the Blue Brain project. I'd read that. I had gone and sought out Sebastian, interviewed him. And then in that year's edit, I put that in there, and I didn't tell Henry and the project I was going to do that. And I posted that publicly. And they were, you know, they were taken aback by that. And their project manager at the time, sent by Henry, when I got there, sat me down and sort of had a talking to with me about how, if I was going to include critics in the future, I would need to tell them about it, not run like, you know, the material by them. They were still, to their credit, they understood my independence and respected it and never challenged it directly. But I think they were, you know, they were a little frustrated that they had given me all this access. And I think that's fair on their part. They'd given me all this access, and then I had kind of blindsided them with this criticism, which they knew. They were, you know, quick to tell me, we know all the criticism, you know, it's not like this is new to us, but just let us know, because when you're going to make your edit, we're going to be in dialogue with these critics when you cut back and forth. And we want to know who we're in dialogue with. So we had that, you know, friendly tension throughout the years, I would call it, of what I'm doing, what their awareness of what I'm doing is. And again, to their credit, they kept letting me come back to do what I was doing. And in the end, you know, I wonder if they knew the extent of the criticism I had captured, because I didn't release anything the last 5 years. I went and, you know, a lot of the material, the most critical material in the film, comes from people responding to the, you know, the open letter and all of the fallout over the Human Brain Project. And that all was material I just kept until the end. So we had a very interesting relationship along the way, but there was no implicit promise or anything about what this film was going to be.
Okay, so this leads to the nicely to the next question. I'm curious how you perceived the shift, if any, in Henry's attitude from year one to year 10, having spent a lot of time with him. I'm wondering because it struck me as a bit arrogant to be so confident about a 10-year timeline to build one of the most complex things known to science. In parentheses, just like Elon Musk's attitude with regards to brain-computer interfaces. Did you see a shift in how he approached his project, idea, / vision as a scientist and not as a messiah?
Over the whole course of the film?
Yeah.
Or the whole course of the 10 years?
Yeah. Wait, can I just say before you answer that, because the messiah aspect, I don't know. My reading of Henry during the film was that he just remained sort of focused and confident, and that the salesmanship part of his delivery was definitely there, but I don't know the full extent of, you know, how arrogant and salesmanship he was. And I don't know if you want to comment on that, but yeah, so maybe just as a preamble to the answer to your the question.
Yeah. Right. So you're wondering if there was material left on the cutting room floor, or you're wondering if I saw stuff that didn't make it in the film that spoke more to those qualities, or?
Well, no, this is from the chat. So that question's from the chat. But just from my reading of it, he seemed sincere in and focused the entire time, and not bitter. He didn't seem terribly bitter, but okay. That was just my reading of it.
Yeah. It's complex, and a lot of the dynamics of salesmanship are complex, because as a salesman, you often believe in the product, you believe in the possibility of the product, but you also, especially I think when you're garnering funding for a dream like this, of a grand vision of where something could get, if all of the variables line up and if the computing track continues on the way you expect it to, and you continue to get better and better machines that can simulate more and more detail. That's one track. You know, you also need to have access and to standardize on the informatics track. You need the data to fit in the right way, right? And be able to load massive amounts of data into the simulation. So there were all these tracks. And when he does the TED talk in 2009, does he know for sure that the tracks are going to line up in 10 years? I don't think so.
Fuck no.
I don't think so. And I don't think anyone, you know, would think that he did. And I didn't. I mean, I trusted him, though, because of the papers and because of his career before that. I trusted that, like other scientists, he wouldn't say something unless he really did think that these tracks could land there in 10 years. And that's where I wonder if I was a little mistaken in that, in that trust, because I think there's a degree of salesmanship that went on with this project over the years. Where potentially there was a little bit of, we need to run out and get a bunch of funding so that we can see, so that we can try to get there, but we're not really sure if we could get there in 10 years. And all of the criticism I ran into then head first a few years in was really that this was a crazy idea that we could do a human brain in 10 years. And I continued to run into that criticism. And to this day, I mean, people who have seen this film and reacted to it think that that's a crazy landmark to be thinking of in any kind of time frame of a decade. And you know, maybe you could get a generalized model of a human brain with very abstracted point neurons or whatever, but to think of that the level of detail they were talking about and were proposing in that initial proof of concepts cortical column that they simulated back in 2009 could be scaled to a human brain, I don't think anyone would believe that. And that's where it's complicated, because I'm not sure even Henry really, really thought that could happen in a decade. It's impossible. It's a fiction. You're kind of writing science fiction as you make the proclamation in a way, and you're maybe hoping that the tracks catch up and science fiction becomes reality. he might have really thought that it could be, you know, Henry really, in my time with him, his thinking is much closer to the kind of futurism of someone like Ray Kurzweil than it is the very traditional academic biologists, many of whom I interview in this film, who are speaking about the Blue Brain Project. But that kind of futurism, you know, it's a way of thinking where anything could be possible in a decade if we just all got together and worked on the same vision in concert. It's just not how the world works, though. So it's a little divorced from reality. I think that becomes problematic when public funds are at stake. So when the salesmanship is from the largesse of one billionaire, and you want to go out and run and try to solve a problem, it's a little bit of a different conversation, I think. And it's interesting to see what the Allen Institute did with the general, you know, the money from Paul Allen. They made tools that have been widely used and so, you know, well regarded in the community as sort of cornerstone now, foundational maps and so forth. So I think it's difficult, you know, but my point is that if they had gone out and tried to do the same project, I don't know if I would have been as critical. But when you're dealing with state funded science, money coming from originally from taxpayers, it's, I think the criticism is you open yourself up to the public gaze, and you should be responsible to absorb that criticism and to deal with it and to respond to it. And you should be in dialogue with it, I think. So I think in many ways this film audits that the kind of salesmanship as in regards to public funds in a great dream like this. But I've gone a bit on a tangent here. Your original question was about how Henry himself changed.
Well, if you could, yeah, sense that change or what sense you had of his change.
Right. So
as a scientist, not a salesman.
Yes. So as a scientist, I saw Henry really continue to focus on the mouse brain the whole time I was working on the
really?
We never even got to the work going on there is just like continues to be completely focused on the mouse brain. They're still trying to work towards a full scale simulation of that mouse brain. And the Cell paper in 2015 was their, you know, their crowning achievement to date from their point of view. And you know, you had a guest who used to work on the project a few episodes ago on your podcast who told you about this great calcium triumph that they had, which I didn't put in the film. I thought it was a little too technical to get into in the film. But
by the way, that guest will remain unnamed. However, I was going to bring up the Blue Brain and Human Brain Project, and I was asked not to.
Yeah. Well, you still did. you still tried to, right? You asked him a couple. Anyway, whatever.
Yeah.
A couple of questions. I was just interested that a lot of people don't want to talk about this project, and people who work there still and people who used to work there, I just think I kind of get it. It's been such a lightning rod for so many years for these people. And a lot of these people are humble scientists who came up through the project and wanted to just, you know, do their work and move on with their careers. And, you know, they shouldn't necessarily have to respond to answer to this stuff directly. So that's fair, but okay, back to the changing as a scientist. So one thing that has changed that I've noticed is that there is no really mention of the human brain anymore. They've scrubbed it from their website. When this started, you know, Henry gave the TED Talk and it was human brain in 10 years. That those were the headlines. That was the press they were ginning up. And there was a roadmap that they were going to do, you know, mouse brain, cat brain, primate brain, and then human brain. And there, I saw PowerPoints with that roadmap laid out. That kind of got scrubbed and has disappeared. And now, I think Henry has realized that being more realistic and targeted with the milestones helps dissuade people from being so vocally critical mm-hmm. towards him, probably. If he just talks about simulating the mouse brain, it's a little more feasible still. A pretty big pipe dream, but a little more feasible than throwing out the human brain 10 years timeline. That's been one change. I don't think that his core beliefs changed in the work. I didn't see him waver one inch, and I was looking for that in the last couple of years of making this film. And you know, in the last interview or two, I'm asking him, you know, do you still believe in this, in this project, the same, and in this attempt to simulate at this level of detail the same way you did when you began? And yeah, the answer was, is always yes. And I assume continues to be. And you know, I think in order to run a project like this and to continue to get the funding that they do from the Swiss government, you have to believe, and you have to have, you know, everyone around the project speaks to the vision of the project. You know, that there is an element of that leadership that has to remain inspired and positive, and in order to, you know, keep the people around him believing in it and keep the funding coming.
I'm going to jump in with a question of my own. And by the way, there's lots of questions in the chat, so nice job, guys, and keep those questions coming. Just a little anecdote. I think I've told this on the podcast before, but when I was interviewing for postdocs, I had a conversation with a fairly new faculty member, and he said that the lab that he came from, his advisor gave him this advice to just say crazy shit, and eventually you'll get the funding, and you might be right. And likewise, and that always stuck with me. And whenever I think of, you know, projects like this or ambitions like this, I had a friend growing up in high school and in college, and it always bothered me so much that when in a group conversation, to overtake, he would just overtake and get attention, he would just speak louder, and he would just yell above everyone else. And it always really bothered me. And that problem exists in science as well. Essentially, that attention seekers get attention. I mean, it's the same with children. And I don't know how to fix the problem, but, and I don't even know if you want to comment on this. Maybe, you know, reflecting on your experience, do you have this same sense that it's an open problem? And if so, how do we fix it?
Yeah, it's kind of like a, I think you've put your finger on a universal problem with human psychology, but we can apply it, we can drill down on it in science in particular. But you know, the scientists in your crowd probably know more about this than I do in terms of the day-to-day pressures that you feel as a scientist to attention seek. I do think scientists operate in a system that incentivizes metrics and pushing out publications and pushing out and being loud about the implications of your publications, and so seeking attention for your metrics, and then writing books that, you know, pump it up even further probably. So I don't know how, I'm not, you know, this is not what I don't design policy. Yeah. I don't know how to change that system, but I just, to affirm what you're saying, I mean, I think yes, people do that, but it's, there is this sort of danger, I think, that this is obvious to people, but when you don't deliver, when you overpromise and underdeliver, that's when public trust and faith in science can potentially erode, and you can promise a lot of, get all this attention for promising nice, shiny things, but then the sort of stultifying slog of the realities of research ensue, and you are in institutions that, from my point of view, and I tried to include some of this critical context in the film, there is a sort of culture of corporate bureaucracy around science and these institutions in many ways. And it's hard, I think, to take risks and play and fail in smaller ways than, and you know, and many people are just pushed to be loud and produce, and produce what I've heard other people call salami publishing, like this kind of just churning stuff out, you know, sort of mimicking what other people are doing, changing it slightly. And there, listen, that there's a mountain of science that is, comes out of that, that is valuable. There are, but you know, there's not maybe as much null results and the sort of other underside of that mountain we could use to see a little bit more, the less loud, the less flashy side. What about those experiments that didn't go the way they thought they would go? And So I don't know how to, I'm not prescriptive with policy or anything.
Come on, yeah. You got to fix it, man. Okay, so another question here. Chris asks, if I remember correctly, what did it feel like when he did not sit down for the last meeting? He, meaning Henry. If you could just briefly take us through that visit, please.
Yeah, that was, so he did sit down for the last two meetings. That was actually, the one where he stood me up was actually the third to last interview that I did with him. So again, to his credit, he came back, even after that, he came back, and maybe it's because he felt bad. And even that year that he stood me up, he made sure to do a video call with me to sort of catch up when I got back to New York. Mm. But it was tough to go over there again, self-funded at that point still.
Oh, yeah.
And make that trip and spend thousands and then get stood up. Yeah. But, and now it was interesting because we'd been in this rhythm of doing it for like 7 years at that point. And I was becoming increasingly critical with my angle. And I think he could probably feel that. And listen, I don't know. I mean, he might have just been intentional it was, but from my point of view,
people are busy.
We had this on the calendar for months. I was coming. I was only around for a few days. It was tough. Yeah. It was a tough one. And it sort of, to me, felt like, my relationship with them was changing a little bit.
This is from Rokas. I like how you pinpointed that simulating imperfections is super hard and might be the necessary ingredient. Do you think using computer science terms to explain the neuroscience concepts are harmful for the field? By the way, you don't have to answer any of these, or any of these questions if it's going to give away too much of the film. Feel free, because to keep it in your pocket, of course.
I would love an example from of the kinds of computer science terms that they're Rokas, thinking in
Rokas,
that question.
If you want to jump in, Rokas, to clarify,
because I would example. Actually something that I talk about sometimes is I worry sometimes. And listen, your show is called Brain Inspired. This is a two-way street. So we were talking about, computer science inspired by brains. And now in the context of this question, brain science that people are using computer language to talk about. I sometimes bristle at the overuse of brain language in computer science. Yes. I think that people dignify their computer science to too large of a degree sometimes by extracting the language of biology that has been hard won by millions of years of biological evolution and just plopping that onto the network that they've designed and saying this thing is a neural network and it learns. And it's like, man, wow. Evolution took millions of years to do that thing, and you've done it in the computer. So I think people just need to be a little careful about bringing the language of biology into computer science. And I get it. Listen, I'm not, it's a little of a bit of a stickler to say like, well, it's not a neural network. I get why people call it that. And of course, and people calling point neurons or, in their deep learned networks, neurons, using the word neuron, it's like, wow, neuron has a lot more going on with it than what you have going on in that model. Well, and so it's like, yes, there's a degree of what neurons do and how they are fit into networks. And that's why we're using it. But I worry that people, that it leads, what it does, and this is why I'm a little critical of it, is it potentially overinflates our sense of where we are with these, with the way in which we're capturing biology in machines. And so one of the things that the question is pulled out of the film, and I intentionally put this line of criticism in the film about imperfections, or I call them tiny mistakes in the film, is that this is something that I was hunting around for in the 10 years of making this film, was how are they capturing true variability and chaos and from biology, stochasticity, we could also say, what are the models to capture that in a computer simulation of biology? And I found in the end that yes, we use very state of the art random number generators to generate some of that noise, and they call it jittering in the Blue Brain simulation. But ultimately, a scientist tells me in the film that, well, we can never know the right kind of variability. And I just found that to be a pretty revealing answer. So ultimately, if you don't know the right kind of variability, then you're really creating a model to do what you want it to do. You're injecting a bit of jitter, just enough. Okay, that seems somewhat realistic, but really I'm going to fit this model to the question I'm answering and that I as the human researcher want to figure out. And it's important to realize, to draw a bit of a line in the sand, that you have not necessarily captured the actual variability that has driven random natural selection over millions of years.
How much did you did you debate how much neuroscience to put in the film versus making it more accessible to the general public?
Yes, this was a difficult balance to strike. Had to put a little bit of basic neuroscience in the film to be able to get to that general public audience. I wanted to not have this just be a film for the field. But I also wanted the film to appeal to the field and to have conversations like this with people who think deeply about this in their professional lives and are very knowledgeable about the subject. And I don't know if we hit the right balance, but that was, yes, the answer is yes. That was an active debate in the edit room. Do we need a little bit of a primer here on what axons and dendrites are? Probably. Yes. We need a little bit of that.
Got to do it. Yep.
Do we need a little section on models? Yep. We got to have a little bit of a thing about what models are. But man, there could have been so many more primers that we went into. This could have been so much longer, this film. It was a real challenge to get this. I always wanted it to be like less than 90 minutes. I feel like for a documentary, I don't like asking people to watch something longer than that. So, and listen, that's my own. I think people are used to these days watching things, you know, maybe longer than that, but that was my challenge. Yeah.
I mean, you know, like all good stories, it's about people.
Yes.
You know, and so I guess you had to have the science in the background at least to sort of extract where people were coming from, perhaps. Harry says, I like the sequence where they debated using 2030 versus 2050. I guess this is toward the end of the film. I wonder if you think Blue Brain could have gotten funded with a 30 plus year timeline. I guess that wasn't on the table, though, was it? I mean, it was a 10 year grant that was being awarded from the government.
Yeah. So the 10 year grant was the Human Brain Project, where there was actually money earmarked. Yeah. For a specific like decade window of a project, which continues to this day. The Blue Brain Project, I wasn't privy to their like inner finances, but my understanding was they actually were funded just yearly, and that they had yearly reviews.
And maybe
they're every 2 years. I'm not sure exactly the pace of the reviews, but I don't believe that the Blue Brain Project was technically funded for 10 years from the beginning. They were funded on a reviewing cycle. It's more that the dream that was set out with what this project will do was 10 years.
I see.
The actual benchmarks had to be reviewed by whatever, you know, committee would come in and look at it. So I don't know that they would have, you know, I don't know that the excitement would have been generated by saying we're going to do this by 2030. That would have felt in 2009 like so far off. I just don't think you get the same kind of response.
Well, you see in the film, I believe, you know, Henry says something like, well, 2050 is just too far away. Let's bump it up.
Right. So that would be the equivalent. Right. So that's how 2030, I think, would have felt in 2009.
Right.
Now,
right.
They were sort of in that scene, they're sort of talking about the session titles for an upcoming summit. And so I thought very interesting to hear them talking about time again. You know, at one point he had been talking about 10 years from 2009, and now here they are.
But again. That's pure sales.
That's not even. It's like, what feels better? What just feels closer and more tangible? It doesn't really have anything to do with what can actually be accomplished by a certain date. Yeah.
At what point, Chris asks, at what point did you become aware that they were kind of doing a bait and switch, dazzling you with the pinstripes rather than the progress and performance, so to speak? That was year three, right?
Year three is when I started to realize there are critics out here. But to be fair, I didn't I didn't yet think in my mind of a bait and switch. And, you know, I also don't know that I would go so far as to call this a bait and switch. People looking at this film and they look at Henry and they, I think when they don't know much about it or they're coming into seeing my film for the first time, I think there's an expectation given what's gone on in our world in the last decade of a kind of story, like an Elizabeth Holmes type story, a Theranos type story of a real like snake oil salesman who like was selling a product that was completely vacuous inside in the end. That isn't this story. So this is more complicated.
It is,
And so, you know, and yes, and as I just mentioned, they have been reviewed very regularly by very serious scientists. I've just seen that there's so much politics in scientists in science. I mean, my goodness, the people who
isn't that so disheartening?
It's just incredible. I'll go and talk to scientists who think that the whole thing is a fraud and that the people who come in to review it are like in the back pocket of this project. Like, it's amazing the stuff I've heard that people won't tell me on camera because of course they won't, you know, it's like, if I was some muckraking investigative journalist writing, you know, an article, maybe I could have gotten those in quotes and really, you know, but again, that's their feeling that I don't know that there's proof of that. I didn't find any proof of that. And, you know, people making claims that the media, that they're like journalists who were friendly to this all those years and stuff. I don't know. I mean, I think that, I never felt a true bait and switch as the question implies, but I did start to feel like, there's a critical response out there that I wasn't familiar with in the beginning that I am becoming more familiar with as of year three of this film. I really felt the fallout after the human brain, after the open letter. You have over 800 scientists speaking out against this thing in an open letter. That was when I thought, wow, I mean, is this completely hot air and should I stop making this film? I thought about stopping after all that because I had to really fall from my, that was really when my dream was crushed about being there. And it was honestly more about like, there's no third act. There's no end here. I'm going to just continue making this film and there will be no moment of that I had dreamed of, which is like at the end of the decade, the switch is turned on and the simulation comes alive. That was my own science fiction dreaming, you know?
But how close did you come to quitting? And did you have, were you working in a vacuum, like super solo, or what, you know, were you in constant contact with your producers and editor? And did anyone try to dissuade you from continuing, or did people try to pump you up and say, come on, man, you can do it. Something will happen.
Just my family. I had no one else. I wasn't working with anyone else on this film for 8 years. I was completely solo.
Did you ever cry?
I definitely had some dark flights home from feeling like I got no footage out of that year. You know, nothing interesting happened. I had to kind of lean into that. I had to lean into the kind of tantric quality of time in this project. There was nothing going there. I mean, listen. From their point of view, it was very exciting every year. There were things going on. They were getting closer to a model of the entire mouse neocortex, which they continued to work on. And I would come home and be like, well, okay, that might be true for them. And they seem very earnest about it. I was here to make a film about a 10-year simulation of the human brain, and we're not going to get there. And so I had to fall from that in a very classic arc of like a coming of age story in a way. I had to like, my heroes had to fall from grace for me to decide what was I interested in. And the rebirth for me in like climbing back into this project was getting interested in these questions of chaos and variability. That was what got me back in intellectually to explore how they were capturing that in this level of detail in a simulation. And once I got interested in that, I felt like I could now explore something in a genuine way each year again. So yeah, I didn't have anyone. I had wonderful producers on this project, but they came in the last couple of years of the film once we got funding and I could actually afford to pay people to work on this project. And then I worked with another editor in the end too. So that was at that point. There was no quitting anymore. We had funding. We were gonna finish the film.
How did you know when it was the end?
I just decided in an orthodox way that I was going to do 10 years. And so ultimately, but I still needed to feel like I had that last trip to Blue Brain Project that tied it up. I was feeling like by year nine that I could feel the ending. There's a particularly potent moment for me in the film. I don't know if it resonated for other people, but for me, it's a potent moment when Henry sort of, we have a long sequence of people making, including Henry, making the 10-year promise over and over again. And Kurzweil is in that sequence too, of forecasting of where we're going to be by certain years. And I just wanted to show that there is a Silicon Valley streak in the kind of salesmanship that Henry was doing all of those years, and the kinship with Kurzweil. And so it resolves with Henry kind of saying, well, a 10-year project, a 15-year project, a 20-year project, well, what do you think? You know, and he was kind of asked me. And we end there on that scene and moves on to, the final year after that. So I honestly, at that point, I was like, okay, so I like, we're wrapping up here. we can work, like, it's kind of, it's all arbitrary in a way, these timelines. I need to just decide how my story wraps up here. And part of that journey too was realizing I needed to put my journey into this film. I did not think from the beginning, and my other two documentaries that I made about North Dakota do not have my journey in the film.
My daughter, who's nine, asked me to ask you. I asked her if she had any questions, and that was her question, is why you decided to put yourself in the film. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, good question. I didn't want to. I was allergic. I never liked documentaries where the filmmaker decides that their story is as important or more important, so you feel like sometimes people decide, than whatever's going on in the film with the subjects that they started following initially. So I didn't want to do it. And I realized by the end that there's something we talk about in filmmaking, like the reliability of a narrator. So we often critique an unreliable narrator, for example. And this is something I started to think about. I was like, who's going to narrate? Who's telling the story of this film? If I'm not telling the story, it's going to have to be Henry, really. I mean, he's the one. I have the most interviews with him. I'm going to have to just keep showing interviews with him, and he'll narrate where this project is each year. But because he maintained his positivist belief in this project the full time and continues to this day, as far as I understand, to believe in it, and has not, you know, hasn't become self-critical or isn't self-effacing at all. I felt like I had to be self-critical and self-effacing in this story in terms of my original salesmanship and awe and sort of being swept away by the salesmanship. I had to curdle that myself in the film and be self-reflective about it. And I didn't know how that was going to happen unless I jumped in and became a character in a way in this film. And it was really because I felt like I had to be critical and I had to be self-critical.
Hmm. You know, could I jump in with a question about the salesmanship? I'm wondering, especially because you mentioned, you know, you had that montage of all these different people saying 10 years, 10 years, 10 years for different projects, although I think they were all computer science related. I wonder how much of it is salesmanship and how much of it is just the perennial human, foibles of underestimating how hard things are in the short term, but then also underestimating how impactful they can be in the long term. It seems like 5-10 years is all, or 20 if you want to be conservative, is always the time frame for the thing, whether it's electric cars or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you think it really was salesmanship in the maybe slightly dishonest sense, or it's just like, we're just bad at estimating timelines, and we always feel like 10 years is the right number.
Yes, I think actually that you have a good point there. 10 years, listen, it felt like the right number for me to, as I said, it was long enough, anything could happen in my film. It was short enough, I could imagine actually doing it. And I think that probably is actually how Henry felt about his promise. Long enough, like, give me that amount of time, I might do it. But, you know, it's also not too much time. You're not going to forget about it. Like, you're going to keep giving me funding to do it. So there's a lot of truth in that. Psychologically, I'd love to see some sort of study about why the 10-year horizon is, you know, attractive in that way. It has probably some proportional relationship to our lifetime or something. You know, the way we think in decades and generations, and there is a lot of our thought that's organized around that. Totally arbitrarily, right? But it's a great point.
I had the thought that the thought just occurred to me a moment ago that your journey, your mental journey, parallels that of a lot of people in neuroscience PhD programs. And throughout their kind of, you get beat down, sort of. You come in wide-eyed, yeah, and think you're going to really do something, think you're going to learn a lot about the brain, and then you start to focus on these narrow questions, things don't work, and it kind of beats you down. And so it's interesting that there are people like Henry that remain super optimistic, and I wouldn't call them wide-eyed, but seem to have escaped this sort of beat down that a lot of us go through. Anyway, that was just a comment. thinking about like timelines also, I had an idea for a business, 5-10 years ago, where it was a business to hold construction companies accountable for their timelines, because like in construction and in all arts, film, all sciences, you're always over budget and over the deadline, but there doesn't seem to be any accountability for it. And I don't know how I would make a profit in this business. I don't know who would pay for it. You know, it would have to be like public funding. But did you go over budget and over time?
I there was no budget. I was self-funding.
Your budget. Yeah.
You know, it was my budget. So I couldn't go over budget and still pay my rent in New York. It's so expensive. But I re-promised, as I said, 15 years, and then I ended up coming in under that reboot. I had done it myself arbitrarily with the Human Brain Project. And then we got funding. We ended up getting these two grants, one from Sloan Foundation, one from Simons Foundation, through their entity Sandbox Films. And you know, we didn't go over. I'm proud to say we didn't go over budget with our grants. Right. We stayed under. We have a little bit left over for marketing now, which is nice. So yeah.
Okay, so back to the science a little bit. There are two questions that are kind of related here. One is, so I'm going to ask them both, and then you can comment on both or either. One's from Michael. I was curious, did the final brain simulation do anything productive, and how long could they run it for? And then a related question from Hannah is, how close did they get to matching the number of cortical columns to the scale of the mouse brain?
Good. Yeah, those are good questions. So I just reframe it a little. There wasn't a final simulation in my film even that I captured. It's ongoing. They don't have a full simulation of a mouse brain yet, and that's what they're working towards still. I've stopped really following so closely the research, honestly. I felt like I did my part for 10 years. I'm not
done.
Really gonna,
you're out.
I'm not going to continue to monitor their releases and everything. It's okay. I've done my part. So, but to answer the question a little bit, the last major release that they had of work was really the Cell paper in 2015. That was when they released their cortical column simulation, showed what it could do, and they were able to mimic in that paper, which is voluminous. It's a huge paper. It's actually like much more about the methodology of doing the simulation. It's a huge method section. But in the paper, they were able to basically mimic some classic electrophysiology papers from in vivo work. And that was how they showed, and I think why they got this paper published eventually. And they had to, as we mentioned before, people had listened to this previous episode with this former researcher at Blue Brain. They were having an issue with calcium levels. They realized that in vitro and in vivo calcium levels are actually slightly different. They made a tweak in the simulation. All of a sudden, the simulation is behaving. It's showing, not behaving, it's not an animal right, behaving. But it's showing signatures of electrophysiology that you would expect to see in a typical cortical slice like they simulated. So That's what it did. That was the big moment as far as what I captured. But people were even skeptical of that. You know, they I think people are skeptical of how much parameter fitting it happens. If the calcium thing could be tweaked so easily, what else could be tweaked to get this kind of excitation that they're showing and these little oscillations they're showing? I don't think that there's anyone who thinks that it's some sort of scam, as we were talking about, that it doesn't actually do this stuff. I just think people are skeptical to the significance of what this model will actually be able to reveal about the brain. So they haven't had results that have I would, from my point of view, have broken new ground in and reshaped our understanding of the brain in any way, in the way that, you know, a discovery like grid cells in the hippocampus or something monumental like that, like there, some sort of foundational work has not come out yet of this project. Not to say it won't, but that's basically as far as the work got that I captured. And then in terms of the question about the columns, my understanding is they really, you know, there is even controversy of the column, the neocortical column, as a unit. People are skeptical that the column, which comes originally from work by Vernon Mountcastle, is actually a unit that could be meaningfully scaled up in a simulation like this, and that maybe there is actually more intricate stuff happening at mesoscales where there are different types of geometric formations and topologies that aren't, it isn't just this like clean column. When you see that their simulation, and there's some of this in the film, it really feels like they're treating the column as a microprocessor, and they're treating each one of these things as a sort of chip, and then they're going to scale it up to the size of a neocortex. And that, listen, that might work. We'll see. I have no idea. No one really knows yet. But it's just important to point out that isn't even a widely like agreed upon concept, that the column is the foundational unit in the neocortex.
I'd say it's fairly agreed upon, but not universally.
Okay. Not universally.
Yeah. I really, Milan says, I really appreciated your metaphor of Cajal at the end. I'll say Ramon y Cajal. Milan, you're supposed to always say Ramon E with the Cajal, is what I learned at some point. Did you spend some time with Henry's family and son?
I didn't get to spend time with his son because he lives in Israel, I believe, and still. And I never made it there for the film, but I spent a bit of time with him and his family in Lausanne, and that was his two daughters and his wife Camilla, who's in the film briefly. So they were very warm to me, and I was at their home. I spent some time with them.
So back to science real quick, and I don't know if you'll have an answer for this. Sammy asks, how scientifically relevant does the community consider those oscillations that emerged after reaching a certain scale?
I can't speak to the community, but I can speak to the you know, I included a bit of the community in the response to it, in the response to that work in the film. When that work came out, Corey Bargman and Zach Manin were quoted. Zach Manin, you know, being one of the fiercest critics of this project, coming from his original co-authorship of the open letter with Alex Puget.
He was very enjoyable in the film, by the way.
Yeah, he's a wonderful interviewee, and I thought he had great stuff to say. It was nice to interview an American over there. He was in Portugal, so I went to Lisbon to interview him. But I just noted that he was less than impressed by what they had shown, the oscillations they had shown in the slice. And Corey Bargman also sort of said, it's a nice start, but there's a lot to do before this airplane takes off, or something, some quote to those effects. And so I did monitor the response a bit, and I felt like it was tepid. I felt like the community didn't feel like this was a revelatory signature of life or something inside the simulation. I didn't get that sense, and maybe people can correct me if they feel otherwise, but I felt like it was, people saw this as like a magnum opus of methodology to get of how to do like a hyper detailed simulation. Not necessarily that the effects coming out of it were you know, all that revelatory or impressive.
Okay. So, by the way, in a weird twist of, fate or coincidence, next, I guess on Monday, perhaps, I think it's on Monday, I'm interviewing someone from the Human Brain Project who gets funding from the Human Brain Project and who does this kind of super detailed, bottom up.
Yeah.
Kind of modeling. So it'll be interesting. I'm going to send him this video and it'll be interesting to get his reaction to the movie as well.
Sure. Anyway,
so it would be fun to do another one of these live things with him, but I'm not sure that that's going to happen.
Well, okay, just to say briefly before you move on, is that I have found that in some of the early screenings we've done with this film, some people have thought that this is like the film about the Human Brain Project. It really isn't. I only went into the Human Brain Project briefly with Henry when he was steering the ship there, and when he proposed the idea, went through all the hoops to get it funded. And a lot of people give him credit for that, rightly so. I mean, he led a neuroscience project to winning this flagship grant that could have gone to any other field. And a lot of scientists continue to get funding from it and do really interesting work. And, you know, as I'm sure your guest will talk about. So Henry did that. There was a lot of problems with his leadership style that people had, and it's a mixed bag, as much of this is. But I didn't continue to follow the Human Brain Project in any way. As soon as Henry was mediated out of his leadership position, I went right back to the Blue Brain Project and continued to make my film about that. And I don't purport to have told or continue, you know, that like the Human Brain Project is its own can of worms, and that it has retooled itself in what looks like a more promising direction, and they are doing other work now. So I just wanted to say that.
And generating methodologies and technologies that are clearly going to be useful. Okay, this is a comment from Anna, and I was going to ask, and then I'll follow up with a question I was going to ask you anyway. She says, I'm in a social environment where people are very confident about, quote, short AGI, artificial general intelligence timelines, end quote. This is, so back to the timelines. I'm curious to see how that will actually develop. So my question for you is, you know, future projects wise, I know that you're kind of taking a break from neuroscience documentation, but, you know, the AGI community is filled with many colorful characters and very smart people, of course. So maybe it's not a question, maybe it's a comment. That would be an interesting you should be the 10-year timeline documentary get person,
right? Auditor.
Auditor. Yeah. Okay. That's a good way to put it. But okay, so this will be leading to my next question, but do you have a sense of the AGI community, or is that something, anything that you're paying any attention to? And do you have a, you know, thinking about your experience with this neuroscience based project, do you have opinions or perspectives on, you know, the AGI community and their timeline? I guess, you know, you put Ray Kurzweil in the film, so.
Yes, right. I do pay attention to it a bit. I mean, I find myself agreeing with the skepticism of Gary Marcus more than I, you know, find myself getting, and people could probably expect that given the tone of my film. I understand why people, again, it goes back to the question before, about the psychology of these 10. I just saw a little Twitter debate open up the other day between Gary and someone, maybe from OpenAI.
He's always debating someone.
Yeah,
I think he debates like 17 people at a time.
Yeah. That's right. About someone who you know, was willing to place a bet that AGI would be here in 10 years. And Gary said, okay, well, what do you want to bet? And he ended up just saying like a t-shirt or something. So I was like, okay, well, that's not much of a bet, but okay. I think like, I would love to make a film about that. I think it's tough to think about doing that now. I'm a little burnt out from doing this. I don't know. I am paying attention to it though. I wouldn't have anything that your listeners, you know, don't know already to say about it. Just that I definitely am a skeptic and come at it from that point of view.
But you're, I think I've heard you mention that you're interested in sci-fi right now, in producing sci-fi, creating sci-fi.
Right. So I wrote and directed this narrative feature called Lapsus, which came out last year. So I'm writing more sci-fi now, and that is sort of what I'm heading towards next. But I do want to go back and forth as time moves on here between documentary and fiction. And I find both to be rewarding in different ways. So I would love to make another documentary at some point. I probably need a little time off from it. And then, you know, if there's an AGI story to be told, I would love to get involved. Although I might have a somewhat critical take on the timelines.
There are always AGI storytellers. I don't know if there's a story to be told, however.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. So this takes me to my next question. So this podcast is ostensibly, although we talk about a lot of different things, about the intersection of neuroscience and artificial intelligence. And I don't know how much you have followed the artificial intelligence boom since, you know, 2012, the deep learning revolution. And now you have all these large language models that are just scaling and scaling. So A, just generally, do you have a perspective and thought about, you know, the artificial intelligence push? I know that you are sympathetic with Gary Marcus in you know, but that's AGI we were just talking about. And then I'm curious, so that happened in, let's say, the deep learning revolution, quote unquote, took off in 2012, although there were many advances before that as well. But that's when convolutional neural networks really came on the scene. And then from then, there have been other kind of milestones and landmarks. And, you know, people are using, neuroscientists are using these artificial intelligent machine learning models to say, try to understand how the brain is doing things and look at the dynamics and compare the activity of the models to brain areas, et cetera. Was there any talk about that within the people that did AI ever come up as an alternative means to understand our brains? Because the flip side of that is, you know, is these super detailed simulations, right? In some right. sense, you could say it's the flip side. Were there any conversations had about that? And then I don't know if you just have a general perspective on it.
Yeah, it is the flip side. So what did come up often was a real skepticism and a disdain for the what was seen as the overhyping and over. It was so funny to hear that it was sort of you guys think that they're overselling something. That's interesting. But there was a lot of criticism from them, and I put a little bit of it in the film about Google's big triumph with AlphaGo beating that player in Go. Right. So I put a little bit in the film of that, because I thought that was just it was interesting to see their disdain for this project that was announcing this amazing achievement and, you know, in AI and whatever. So I there was talked about like that. And there's also, even going back further, there was a in the beginning there, when I first got involved in the project, and this was my first whiff of criticism, but I didn't even take it seriously, was when Henry Markram was beginning and was really involved with IBM because they were supplying the machinery. There was an IBM researcher named Dharmendra Moda, I believe, who had come out around that time with what he was calling like a point neuron model of a cat brain or something. There was some sort of point neuron model he'd come out with. It was getting a lot of hype. Henry wrote some sort of open letter about Moda's point neuron model, being very critical of it. And I remember it because it was an early taste of what became even a wider rift between these two projects and these two efforts, a really hyper detailed simulation of the brain from the bottom up and a deep learned convolutional neural net built model that was extracting principles of biology, as we've talked about, but wasn't worrying about glia and vasculature. So I think that might be a bit of a false rift, as you've identified, that there's ways in which the tools of AI now will be able to cross the rift and help. And I've heard of that from other labs. It's not really something I followed in this film, but, you know, automated techniques to improve understanding of the brain, basically foisting AI upon, I know this is something you talk about a lot on the show, but using the techniques of AI to improve biological neuroscience and to speed things up and to automate things so that humans don't have to spend hours at the bench doing them and all of that fun stuff. I will say that something else to note here, which I happened a bit after my film was done, but it might be interesting to your audience, is that Henry ended up doing a spin-off company called Innate. And they have a website up people can check out. It's INAIT, and it's an AI startup that he has in Lausanne, where he's using insights from the Blue Brain Project to basically, it feels like what they're doing from their website is to create like a sort of Watson styled AI model that could be useful for businesses. And so it seems like, I don't know if they have any actual use cases yet or anything, but it's not a deep learned network. What they're sort of marketing it as is different than AI, because it is from, the insights are generated from these hyper detailed models of real brain. Henry is now dabbling, it seems, in this sort of like booming business of business services from AI. And, you know, there's a long history of publicly funded research being spun off into patents. And so Henry, I also noticed that Henry now has a few patents he's filed about related to the Blue Brain simulation. You know, there's a long history of that, of scientists sort of spinning off into private businesses and filing patents and what have you. But I also noticed that as I talk about in the film, there are a number of researchers who have left Blue Brain and moved to AI. And Elif Mueller was one of the head of the simulation platform, moved to Mila in Montreal. And then there are a couple others now have gone to work more in AI. So there is actually this sort of like highway between the two, that I think this rift is a little, you know, it's more of a competitive energy than it is a real like academic or intellectual rift. There's a lot of crosstalk going on.
Do you still consume, enjoy and or believe TED Talks?
I haven't watched a TED Talk in maybe a decade. So I actually don't. I haven't watched a TED Talk in a long time. I don't have anything against them. I maybe it's a little dangerous. Like if I watch another TED Talk, I'll make another 10-year film. I don't know. I consume more podcasts these days.
You're gonna be drawn in. Yeah, it's interesting because right now in neuroscience, there's this well, at least from the slice that I talk with a lot of people who are into these low dimensional dynamical structures. And it's all about how to relate those to cognition. And, you know, I've been in around enough to know that. So there's this kind of hype right now in neuroscience. And because there's been a lot of traction using these kinds of methods to relate populations of neural activity to ongoing behaviors and cognition. But I immediately am like skeptical, and I don't know how to articulate my skepticism, but it feels good that I'm skeptical because I don't want to make a 10-year documentary about it. I'm also excited about it, but that's kind of the way that I feel about artificial intelligence too, and neuroscience writ large. So do you sense that you have a more measured discernment when things are being hyped up just in general?
Yes, I would definitely say measured. If not, I am more critical now. I don't think that this is the type of person who would start making a 10-year film again. Like, yes, when you do have that kind of criticism as a filter for what comes in now, you have to check that too. It's important to check your own criticism and your own bias and not overlook something that is, you know, very, you know, I listened with care because I really respect her work. And it's someone who I've been interested in a long time in neuroscience, who I've felt like is very different from Henry.
Eve Marter.
You got it. I thought you might. Yeah. That's Eve Marter. So I listened with care to your recent talk with her, cause I just think she's fantastic. And, you know, I think that, So I was interested with what she had to say about modeling and about where these machines might take us. And she seems, you know, a bit on the positive side about.
Surprisingly.
Yeah. So that's nice to hear. And it actually made me look at think to myself for a second and go like, I got to be open to this stuff still, because, you know, look at this amazing scientist who's focused on the same little network. And, you know, it's only little from our point of view. It's a vastly complex network in the gut of a lobster for all these years. And, you know, she's stayed open to the possibilities of machine learning and modeling. And she's continued to use modeling in her work very effectively. So it's important to stay open. I am more, my criticism actually comes more from the sort of like cultural and political implications of some of this work, where I see that I worry that the AI hype machine kind of leads to a culture where these things are used for labor surveillance, and like the actual applications of AI in our world have so much more to do with the ways in which our market, the marketplace, our economy, and the way in which labor is organized these days is broken. And I worry about, I have much more sympathy with the kind of like ethical criticisms of AI, and I hope that those are taken more seriously as time goes on too, and aren't just ethics for ethics' sakes and sort of like nice dressing upon the top of the AI cake, but actually get baked into the cake itself.
Something else that has bothered me, again, this is just more of a comment. Something that has bothered me is hero worship in science, because people are, there is hero worship across all different sectors in society and stuff, but I think, especially in AI, talking about the godfathers of deep learning, and people are worshipped like Jeff Hinton, Jan LeCun, and stuff. And I have a really measured take on that as well. I think admiration is one thing, but it's borderline worship in many cases. And do you is within Blue Brain, did you see any kind of hero worship of its leader?
Yes, this is probably important to continue doing work, speculative work that doesn't have, you're not. I think as a human being, when you're doing work, and I felt this with my film too. Like, it's hard to not release. This is why I was releasing stuff in those first 5 years. You want to have a dialogue with other people in your community. You want to be either feel like you're helping them by providing insights through the podcasts you're releasing or the episodes of your yearly film update you're releasing. And as a scientist, I can imagine, although I've never done it myself, you want to feel like the work you're doing has an actual impact in your lifetime in the community of humans you live amongst. And when you're doing such a long-term speculative project that's building a model from the bottom up over so much time and is starting with a mouse, and you might not even get to it's like a cathedral, it's like you're building, you might not in your generation ever see this thing finished. What keeps you in it? What keeps you bound to the work? And I think it is a deep part of our psychology that hero worship and the following of a powerful leader is something that can keep you doing work. And I think we've all felt that to a degree. And it, it might feel a little dirty after the fact, but like when you get out of that and you're like, oh God, what was I taken with there? But I think we've all been there. And I did feel a bit of that at the project. I mean, everyone talked with this same vocabulary about the vision of the project. And there's actually a wonderful anthropologist named Tara Mahfood who did her dissertation on the Blue Brain project and was there overlapping with me a bit. So she's written a very academic text, but nicely academic. Like, it goes, it's much more able to be much more detailed than my film can be about this kind of thing we're talking about the sort of sociological dynamics within that project and the leadership style and this use of the vision as this kind of, shining light on a hill that everyone was walking towards. And that, I think, it happens with these figures you're talking about. It helps us walk towards something that is undefined.
All right. No, it's been an hour and a half almost here. Before my last question, and if anyone else has any more questions, put it in the chat or just speak up. But is there anything else from the film that you'd like to highlight? Joys, concerns, more terror? And then before I ask you a final question.
No, I think we've covered a good deal of it. In fact, I don't want to give away too much, because I would like people to still go out and watch this movie we've been talking about. Yeah.
It's a great film. And again, I want to thank you for just letting my podcast supporters screen it. I got a couple emails already saying that it was a great film and just appreciative that you did that. So thank you for that. My last question to you is, given that, this film has taken you a really long time, and, you're kind of done with communicating with the Blue Brain project, and and you're kind of done with neuroscience for now, but you're going to release this film. And I know you've done a lot of screening, so you've already gotten a lot of feedback, but you're going to release this film. It's going to go out to a wider audience. Are you prepared for blowback? Are you prepared? You know, maybe my question also is, what has been the feedback, the nature of the feedback? Has it been half positive, half blowback, or it must have been a small proportion of blowback? And are you prepared to sort of re-engage? And I know we've already just had this conversation, but re-engage with those kinds of discussions.
Yeah, I feel like when people watch a film, you know, and want to engage in good faith criticism or a dialogue, I'm here for it. They've watched the film, they've engaged. I owe it to people to engage a bit. So I'm not just going to walk away from this. And if there are conversations to be had, I'm more than glad to have them. I have had a good deal of feedback, yes, already, because we've been doing a lot of screenings around at universities and other institutions for about a year now. And they've been generally, you know, warm audiences and receptive, and some, you know, some probing questions about my methodology and how I went about it and my relationship with the project. And that's all wonderful. Certainly the toughest thing, has been the dialogue with the Blue Brain Project and with Henry, because, and I think you're kind of asking about that in a way too. But that is difficult, just because I had a feeling it was coming, because I had seen over the years, every time there was something written, every time a journalist went in and tried to do a piece, and usually the way journalism is done and documentaries are done is on a much shorter, you know, time scale. So they come in, they do interviews, they write a piece in Wired or in wherever. And that happened many times over the time scale I was there making my film. So I got to see other journalists come in, talk to Henry, talk to other people, write their piece. And there wasn't much positive press over that decade, to be honest. And it, you know, it culminated in Ed Yong and wrote a fairly critical piece not too long ago, sort of also calling out the fact that this 10-year promise didn't come to fruition, just to remind people of that. So anytime something like that would happen, I would hear from Henry and the project when I would get over there the next time, like, oh, these journalists, no one gets it right. You know, these basically a sweeping critique of journalists trying to understand the project. No one was taking the time. No one was really engaging with the science, and they all got it wrong. And I had a feeling the same would come for me at some point too, even though I was treated a little differently because of my time scale. I was the one who hadn't released the thing yet. I was still trying to understand. I kept coming back, you know. So when I did release my thing, they had a very sharp, similar response right directly to me. And I sent the film before I had locked it to Henry as a sort of good faith agreement I had with him, where I was going to show him the film. Really, for me, it was for fact checking more than his editorial feedback. I wanted to know if I had gotten, you know, basic things wrong. And they pointed out a couple of things, like, oh, you use this, clip of a celebration at celebrating the wrong moment. And good, I changed some of that. Made sure I fact checked and got that stuff right. They had much more sweeping editorial feedback about my take on the project and my interpretation of the tepidness, let's say, for example, to the reception of their cell paper, stuff like that, which is, you know, they purported to know the objective truth of how their project stands in the world. There is no objective truth about subjective responses to this work. And so I'm not purporting to have made an objective film. I am someone who believes documentaries are always, to a degree, subjective. Every time you make a cut and assemble something, you're bending time, you're putting someone's words after another person's words, changing the context they're heard in. And that is the editorial process. It's subjective. This is my point of view, this film. And I anticipated the blowback. It happened. I believe Henry really doesn't like the film. There was almost a little bit of a legal threat. Although I feel very secure in the way I went about it and crossing.
It's not even close to slander. It's not that, like.
Yeah, yeah. I think that they feel like it is and
sure, some sensitive.
So yeah. I'm pretty secure in feeling like it isn't. And I'm also buffered by conversations I had that I hope to have with Henry, with like someone like Elif Mueller, who's in the film, who was Henry's right-hand man for many years. Elif, you know, left the project. And when he viewed the film, he texted me right after. He said, you know, this is tough for me to watch, but I think you did a really good job. And we had a dialogue for a film festival where we had like an hour long debate kind of about the film. And that was actually wonderful. I love doing that. And it's productive because people get to see both sides talking to each other. The behind closed doors, like threatening sort of animosity isn't helpful, because I feel like I did stuff above board and was respectful. And by the way, I always credit them for, you know, keeping the door open for me and giving me access, because that's a difficult thing to do too. I mean, if you're a scientist giving a documentarian access for 10 years, boy, that's a big ask. So they did that. They let me in, and they're to be credited for that. So I anticipate maybe some more criticism, sure, but it can't be harder for me to deal with than the relationship with Henry, the fallout I've had with Henry in the project. Because after 10 years, it's hard to see it just crumble like that. But I kind of had to do it for the independent angle that I took with the film. And that was the sacrifice.
Noah, impressive. It's an overused phrase, tour de force, but kudos to you for sticking it through. And just what a hell of a project, man. So congrats again. I hope the premiere's fun. Send me a picture with a drink in your hand, please, at the after party. So great. Thanks again, and I appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much, Paul. It was a great chat, and thanks for having me on.
I alone produce Brain Inspired. If you value this podcast, consider supporting it through Patreon to access full versions of all the episodes and to join our Discord community. Or if you want to learn more about the intersection of neuroscience and AI, consider signing up for my online course, NeuroAI, The Quest to Explain Intelligence. Go to braininspired.co to learn more. To get in touch with me, email paul@braininspired.co. You're hearing music by The New Year. Find them at thenewyear.net. Thank you for your support. See you next time.